I'm JJ.
And I'm Dan.
And we are the Men Who Explain Miracles. Welcome back to The Men Who Explain Miracles, a podcast where we discuss impossible crime fiction.
In the last three episodes, we took an in-depth look at the so-called top 15 locked room mysteries of all time, as compiled by Ed Hoke and a host of mystery authors, historians, and experts in 1981. Big thanks to everyone who listened to that, who contacted us, who debated over on our blogs. It was absolutely brilliant. But one request that kept coming up a lot was that myself and JJ tell you our top 15 locked room mysteries. So this episode and next episode, we're going to tell you what we think are our top 15 locked room mysteries of all time.
So we have each written a list of what we consider to be our favourite 15 locked room and impossible crime novels. Dan does not know what's on my list. I do not know what is on his. We're going to discover each other's selections as these episodes go along. And because Dan is slightly more organized than I am and has been able to impose an order on his list, we're going to have a slightly different format for his episode, for his list, which will be the next episode, to what we are going through my list in this episode.
Now, what I like about the fact that we don't know each other's lists is that I think you mentioned in one of the other podcasts that we tend to agree quite a lot on a lot of things. And this could be a first, listeners. There could be some pretty off-the-wall disagreements happening here. Who knows? We might be fine.
If there is too much in the way of violence, I will edit it out. It's fine.
We could have an outtakes of just violent moments from the podcast. Let's hope that doesn't turn into a murder, a real one.
Very true.
What was it like for you actually trying to compile this, reflecting on Ed Hoke's list from the last few episodes as well? How did you feel? What was it like?
What I'm very aware of is, I feel like I've read hundreds and hundreds of impossible crime fiction locked room novels. Trying to pick my favourite, or what I consider to be the best 15, it was very difficult because I got to 13, and then if I had 13, I then had 24. And trying to hammer down those last two was just a nightmare. So, I've had to introduce various criteria to help limit the list.
Yeah.
And sort of help limit my selections.
And what was your criteria? What have you applied to this list to help you decide? Because I think, in a sense, these lists come out of our personalities, of experience, what we love about this genre. So what is it about your list that makes it specific to you?
Okay, so there were several criteria that I had. The first is the Ed Hoke list was compiled in 1981, so I made that a cutoff point. In fact,
great.
I think the latest book I've got is from the late 70s. So I wanted to make sure that I was only choosing books that would have been open to the people who took part in the Hoke list. That was
sure.
The first thing.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Secondly, inside of that, I wanted the books to be good books. So you can often get a very good impossibility hidden in a book that is frankly hard work. So
sure.
Something like The White Priory Murders by Carton Dixon, for instance, mm-hmm. is a brilliant impossibility, but I do very much feel as if I fought that book rather than I read it. The impossibility when you get to the solution is amazing, but I don't think the book around it is anywhere near as good. The other thing I wanted as well was I wanted the impossible crime element to actually be quite a major part of the book.
Yeah.
Because you see something like Edmund Crispin's The Moving Toy Shop makes it onto a lot of impossible crime lists.
Yes, indeed.
But there's an impossible murder in that, which to my memory is set up and resolved in about 5 pages. It's a very, very, very minor element of that book. So I wouldn't consider that an impossible crime novel. I consider that a novel that features an impossible crime.
That's an interesting distinction.
And then my final criteria, my blog is called The Invisible Event, and in one of the very earliest posts I put up, I explained my choice behind that name, and because I'm pretentious, there are about 3 reasons for it. One of them is I love this idea in really well-written detective fiction of cluing, where something is passed right in front of your nose and you miss it completely. This idea of an event happening that, to all intents and purposes, is invisible, because you are so well misdirected away from it.
Mm.
And what I wanted was books where there is a particular moment or there are particular moments of cleverness where you can look back and go, oh man, I totally should have seen that. Because, for instance, Policeman in Armour by Rupert Penny is a brilliant, very clever, impossible crime novel, but there's no particular... It just happens with this very steady accrual of slight misdirection, and you're very, very gently just pushed off course, if you like, which is incredibly clever and takes a huge amount to do. But I want the impossibility to be a very much kind of... real kind of slap on the head moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I just love the cleverness where the best of these authors were able to smuggle something right under your nose, and you kind of sit back with that shock revelation.
You found it difficult to prepare an order, actually order these books.
God, yes.
So the format we're going to take is...
So the format we've got is I'm literally just going to pull them out of a hat. I've written them on bits of paper and jumbled up the bits of paper. I am as surprised as anybody to find the order in which these are going to come out.
Well, here we go. The first from the hat is Murder on the Way by Theodore Roscoe. Very exciting.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I could be accused of a certain amount of bias in this because, as we discussed in an earlier episode, I was partly involved in getting this republished recently. I do also legitimately think, as we have discussed at great length, it is a very, very, very clever and extremely entertaining succession of impossibilities.
Absolutely.
It should be more widely read. It really should. I think it's a genius piece of writing.
Absolutely agree. And it's that kind of absolute cavalcade of stuff coming at you, you know, 100 miles an hour. And in terms of the central impossibilities and your criteria of having these huge, powerful revelation moments, I mean, it absolutely has that.
Mm.
Next out of the hat is another classic, another one we've talked about in depth, and it is Rim of the Pit by Haig Talbot. And just like Murder on the Way, is another kind of multitudinous selection of impossible crimes coming at you from all angles.
Yeah, I feel we discussed the fact that was our inaugural episode. So I don't have anything to add to that. It's brilliant. It's a superb, very clever book. Go back and listen to episode one.
Absolutely. And I think always what sticks with me from that book is the combination between powerful, huge locked room problems and then all the tiny, small details. Mm. I think it's a book that balances everything so well.
Mm. Yeah, I agree.
Next one out of the hat is one that I haven't read, but very much want to, and that's Case for Three Detectives by Leo Bruce. Now, this has been on my to-be-read pile for a long time, at your suggestion, because I needed to read a little bit more Christie, Sayers, and Chesterton to get a sense of the satire that's going on here, but I won't spoil it any further. Why is this in your list?
Because it has a very classic locked room throat-slashing, and there are four distinct solutions offered, which is kind of incredible in itself. So those of us who can't even imagine how to write one impossible crime solution, to have four in a book is sort of amazing. It is also a tremendously funny book. Like, I read it at exactly the right time when I was just starting to get bored of Chesterton, and I was just starting to get bored of Sayers. And the way Bruce takes off Whimsy and Brown, and the way in which the sleuths that he has standing in investigate in exactly the same manner as those detectives.
Brilliant.
And the fact that the Whimsy takeoff is called Simon Plimsoll. It just everything about it works superbly, and it's hilariously funny and very, 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 very clever.
Mm. There's not a lot of authors, contemporary and from the Golden Age, who can pull off satirical or humorous locked room mysteries and Golden Age style mysteries.
Yeah.
Crispin was another one I could think of.
Yeah.
Who pulled that off. But I'm glad this is on your list just for that reason.
Yeah.
So I'm excited to read it myself. Yeah. Next up is another favourite of mine and yours. It is Invisible Green by John Sladek. Why is this one on the list?
This is one from the Hoke List we talked about before. I think it was unjustly low on that list.
Yeah.
You know, but I do think it's incredibly fresh, considering it was published in the late 70s when a lot of impossible crime stuff felt like it had been done, and certainly the subgenre was in decline. I do feel as if it's a tremendously fresh and a tremendously invigorating and enervating read.
Mm. And also what new light it brought to an already well-established genre. And it feels like one of the few books, although it's not from the golden age, say from the 20s to the 50s, it's a little bit later on, but it feels like one of those books that would still work now, that would really, if it came out today, would be still fresh and exciting.
No, completely.
And make so much sense. Okay, the next one out of the hat is Policeman's Evidence by Rupert Penny. Again, one I haven't read, but I know you're a huge Penny fan, so talk to us about why Policeman's Evidence is in there.
This is one of those books that has what I talk about when I say an invisible event, where it just smuggles a very important thing right under your nose.
Mm, yeah.
And it's very prepared for, so you're not even looking for it. And the scheme overall around it is hilariously entertaining. The way in which it's not just about this one bit of misdirection or these two key bits of misdirection. There is this just like ridiculous, almost feels like a parody, sort of trying to break a code to help find a treasure sort of thing. And it's the kind of solution. Penny wrote a lot of cryptic crosswords.
Mm.
And it's the kind of solution that you'd feel someone like, you know, Dan Brown just wouldn't even begin to attempt this sort of puzzle. It is like when the puzzle is explained, it's insanely complicated and very good fun. And on top of that, you have this very intricate, very deliberately structured impossibility that I honestly believe 98% of people reading the book would completely sail past. And I think this is one of the books that best demonstrates what he does so well.
Penny gets a bit of criticism. I don't know his work very well, but it's of the kind of being a little too meticulous or something along those lines. Why do you think it works, this kind of setting each piece in such kind of fine detail?
See, I don't think he is too meticulous at all. I think what I particularly like about Penny is that he's really funny.
Okay,
he's really, really funny. It's not funny in the parodic sense of Bruce or Crispin, but his characters are actually extremely humorous. I think he was very wise to a lot of the tropes and the trappings of GAD. I personally, like all of the Penny books I've read so far, I personally think they are all better than, for instance, early period Ellery Queen, where everything is just, everything feels so false. Everything feels like almost literal chess pieces being pushed across a board.
Sure, yeah.
Here are 47 characters. Mm. I mean, Penny does something that I think is very difficult to do, and that he can really keep you guessing inside of a very small cast.
Mm.
You know, Christiana Brand was probably the only other person who could properly routinely keep you guessing inside of a small cast.
Very, very hard to do. Very exciting when it's done well.
Yeah, I don't think saying that he's meticulous is necessarily fair, because meticulous is used as a synonym for dull.
Yeah.
And I think dull is absolutely the last thing that I would say Penny is.
And it's hard, as you say, to have those chess pieces moving, but to get it to feel authentic and real. So to hear that he does it so well is really exciting.
Mm.
So we're through the first five. Let's get into the next five. Let's see what we've got. Interesting.
Mm.
One I have absolutely no idea about. This is Inherit the Stars by James Hogan. Tell our listeners and tell me what this book's all about.
I think this is going to catch quite a lot of people by surprise.
It has caught me.
I am a big fan of these crossover mysteries where you've got something SF that does an impossible crime aspect.
Great.
And Inherit the Stars, I think, is probably the best example of an impossible SF mystery. A man is found on the moon, carbon dated to be 10,000 years old in a full functioning spacesuit.
Huh.
And yeah, I mean, that's it.
Great.
And the magnitude of what Hogan has to do over the course of that book, I mean, that is properly epic.
Mm.
Trying to get a 10,000 year old man in a spacesuit on the moon, and there are other complications that come in. It is such a grander problem compared to trying to slit someone's throat in a room. No,
sure.
No less complicated in a sense, but it draws in so many different elements. Mm. It's a little bit dry at times because there's a lot of very hard science in there. But part of this list as well is wanting to acknowledge books that aren't normally talked about. I think we tend to go back to the same well quite a lot of the time. And I would really like to see these crossover mysteries discussed more and get more credit for the way in which they put their feet in two camps so well. And I honestly, this is the way he resolves this is just just superb. It's a real Epicurean's delight, it really is.
The next one up is an absolute favourite of mine. Really nice to see this come out of the hat. And that is The Reader Is Warned by Carter Dixon. The name of my blog,
the name of your blog. Look at that.
I love this one so much. Tell us about it. Why is it on your list?
I only read this one fairly recently.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And was just delighted by it. And again, it does all of the things that you want it to do. I think for me, the way the books that John Dixon Carr wrote under his Carter Dixon nom de plume, the way they distinguish themselves from the John Dixon Carr book is I feel the Carter Dixon books are just a little bit more out there. The problems are typically a bit larger than life. Mm. And occasionally some of the solutions can also be a little bit larger than life. What I love about this is a series of impossible murders where there's no sense of how they've been committed, first of all, and secondly, who could have actually committed them. What I particularly like about this is it is this perfect combination of character, psychology, and opportunity.
Totally agree.
And yeah, it's one of the few times, I think, in all of my impossible crime reading that someone gets those three strands and just makes them wind as perfectly as Carr does here.
Next out of the hat is The Footprints of Satan by Norman Berrow. Tell us about it.
I just love this book. Berrow is someone who goes up and down a bit in terms of quality. I've just reviewed a book of his on my blog that was not one of the best of his. But when he is good, he is so on form. And what I especially enjoy about this is it's told of the complete lack of ornamentation. Mm. It is essentially snowfall in a small village overnight, and people wake up in the morning to discover footprints, this trail of footprints, as if from some cloven-hoofed animal that pursues this impossible route. So it's on the top of hedges and on the roof of buildings, and then it sort of appears in the middle of nowhere and equally vanishes in the middle of nowhere. And the whole thing is just told with a complete, there's no deliberate attempt to add any additional, let's say, satanic atmosphere or any whiff of brimstone. He just tells you what happens and what it looks like, and there's like a 20-page section where you just talk through the route that these footprints take as more people come out to see what happened. And it is just such a beautiful book. I don't know quite what else to say about it, to be honest.
It feels like that's another one on your list. These books, a little bit larger than life, a little bit of a different problem, a different angle on the impossible crime. And I mean, that's what makes the genre so brilliant, is that it can keep being pushed down.
Mm.
Next up, another classic, The Plague Court Murders by Carter Dixon. Tell us why this made it to your top 15.
There's one chapter in this book that I don't like, and that's it. Everything else about it is just note perfect. It contains a seance, and I love a debunked seance. It contains a man stabbed in the back when he's in a hut surrounded by mud, and there are no footprints in the mud, and the hut is locked on the outside, it's bolted on the inside, windows are too high and barred, the chimney is barred, there's no way anyone could possibly get in, and he's found stabbed in the back, and the dagger that stabbed him is left in the room. It demonstrates Carr's superb ability with adjectives to just introduce tone very effortlessly. It is actually tonally almost the exact opposite of The Footprints of Satan. The Footprints of Satan is told with zero ornamentation at all and is incredibly effective for the problem just being left blank and impossible. This highlights, I think, where Carr really set himself apart, that the problem is blank and impossible, but also the way he writes in this kind of rising sense of terror and the way he works in this brilliant alacrity around it is just note perfect.
It's one of the only impossible crime novels that I've read and actually been scared
nice.
By some elements of it
nice.
And thinking, that is actually really creepy, that is really horrific.
Yeah.
And I don't mean in a gory sense, I mean in this sense of terror, like you said, building up.
Yeah.
Another masterpiece. Next up, some would say the most classic in the genre, The Mystery of the Yellow Room by Gaston Leroux. Tell us about it.
So again, it's another one from the Hoke List. We talked about this at fairly decent length before, so I don't want to repeat myself. Got everything off to a really good start and still remains fresh.
It was one of my earliest locked room reads, and I stayed up all night to read it. Absolutely amazing. I think this is the final five.
Okay.
We are into the final five, out of the hat, The Home Straight. And here it is. This is the one I was waiting for, JJ. It is The Problem of the Green Capsule by John Dixon Carr. Tell us about it, my friend.
Now,
tell us about it.
There was a certain amount of debate on my blog as to whether this is an impossible crime or not. I would just like to point out that The Chinese Orange Mystery by Ellery Queen made it onto the hope list. And that is not an impossible crime at all. The Green Capsule is an impossible crime. I'm not having an argument on this. The Green Capsule is an impossible crime.
And I agree here. There's no blood being shed. No, don't worry. No.
It is the single finest novel of detection ever written. It is as close to perfection, I think, as Carr ever came, and therefore anybody in Golden Age detection ever came. We want to keep these episodes to about 35, 40 minutes, so I can't talk about everything that's so good about this book. Some of you may remember that there is a bit towards the end of this book that I do not remember, or somebody being shot in a car that I just have no recall of. I'm convinced that is some elaborate April Fool being perpetrated against my person, and I can, in fact, remember this book in clear, perfect detail, and it's amazing and beautiful and the finest novel of detection ever conceived and ever put down on paper.
Here's a question for you. If you could have made these into an order, do you think this would have been number one?
Oh, yeah.
Well, there we go. Oh, you heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Next up on the list, from the hat, is Whistle Up the Devil by Derek Smith. I deeply want to read this book. I've wanted to read it for years, and it's obviously now republished, and I will get to it soon, so I'm more excited than ever for you to tell us about it. Go for it, JJ.
I was so thrilled when this got republished. I spent about a year trying to track it down, and I got a copy, the Thriller Book Club edition. It's over there on my bookshelf. I got a copy of the first, I think the only, and very small print run. And then literally about a month after I tracked it down, Locked Room International announced that, that they were going to be republishing it. So, I mean, I have both copies, because of course you would. It's just a wonderful book, and it's a real shame, firstly, that it's not more talked about, and secondly, that Smith only wrote two books. His second novel, Come to Paddington Fair, wasn't actually published until after he died. And I actually think Come to Paddington Fair is a better book. It has a bigger cast, and it manages its situation in a much more competent way. Whistle Up the Devil is definitely much more about the impossibility. It has, we talked about small casts earlier, it has a very small cast, and so there is a chance that people will guess and will tumble to it before they're actually told, just purely by, you know, probability of who it could be. One of the things I especially enjoy about this is there is a clear moment when the detective is told the key piece of information, or comes across the key piece of information that unseals the entire scheme. And you are told that he has just come across the key piece of information and that he therefore knows what the scheme is.
Nice, yeah.
And obviously you don't know what that piece of information... You have also been told it. But again, it's that idea that, that invisible event just being floated in front of you, on top of which it is staggeringly, breathtakingly clever. The two impossible crimes, the first one is brilliant, the second one is so cleverly set up and so cleverly established. It is honestly superb. And when you've read Whistle Up the Devil, you must also read Come to Paddington Fair, which is, again, a marvellous, I think, as I say, a slightly better book, a much bigger cast. It develops in a slightly more organic way.
We talked a little bit about ornamentation with Norman Berrow and with Carr. What about ornamentation here? Whistle Up the Devil. It suggests to me another kind of satanic thing.
What's really nice about this is this slightly falls more in the Berrow school, in that the way the problems are presented, you're just told, here's the problem. Here's a guy stabbed in the back. Here's a guy strangled to death, and there's no way that it could have been done. There are witnesses around who are able to ascertain. And it's Smith. I get the impression that Smith knows how good the problems are.
Okay.
And so he's not trying to hide anything by making it ridiculously ornamented.
Elaborate. Yeah.
Yeah. He just tells you what's happening. And I really like that. You know, it's not to say it's just like blank verse poetry or anything like that, but it is. It's very cleanly deployed, shall we say.
Another big one, out of the hat. Another one that I haven't read, simply because how can you get a copy of it? It is The Death of Jezebel by Christiana Brand. Now, I know you love this one.
I do.
So tell us about it.
Just ever so briefly, all I want to say about this is it contains the finest example of an invisible event, of a clue being thrown in front of you ever. I will obviously not reveal what that is. It's a wonderful puzzle. Said earlier, you know, Brand does this astonishing job with a really tiny cast. Like, you're given a list of seven people at the start of the book. Three of them die. One of the other four has to be the murderer. And anybody who actually figures it out with not guessing is doing an incredible job.
Okay, last two. Another massive favourite to me. I'm really glad to see this coming out of the hat. It is Till Death Do Us Part by John Dixon Carr. What do you got to say about it?
Nothing. It's amazing. Again, it's one of the best examples of detective fiction ever written. What I love about this is the imbrications of the plot around and inside of the impossibility. How the impossibility is part of a scheme, and the wider scheme outside of that is astonishingly clever. This is from the mid-40s, when Carr would structure his books with these... Sort of halfway through, you would suddenly get this development that changes everything. This, I think, is one of the best midway reveals that Carr has ever done.
Gosh, absolutely.
And the impossibility is very, very, very clever, but the way in which the impossibility feeds into the bigger scheme, and the bigger scheme itself is brilliant enough that it doesn't require the impossibility, but it also has this very clever impossibility as a part of it.
What a finisher. The last one out of the hat is And Then There Were None by Agatha Christie. Now, I didn't expect this, but it makes a lot of sense, actually. Tell us about it.
It's just a magnificent book. It's not a novel of detection, as we know. There's no detective. Mm. But it is just that problem. If you've got everybody on an island, and everybody on the island is murdered by someone, then who was the murderer?
Yeah.
If there's no one left alive, and there's no way that anybody could be hiding anywhere else on the island, who is the murderer? And it's not obviously an impossible crime until you get to the end. But I'm assuming this is something that the people listening to this will have read or seen the televisation of it from recently. I feel to a certain extent this book is very much Christie's The Hollow Man, in that it is the book that everybody immediately recommends. And so it's almost like a lot of lip service is paid to it. But I do think we do need to take a moment every so often to appreciate just how damn good it is.
Yeah.
And how intricately put together it is. And how beautifully it misdirects. I read this in like a 2.5 hour train journey, and I stormed through it so fast that the pages were smoking by the time I got to the end. And I will never forget the moment of revelation in this, when you suddenly realise who is guilty and how it's been worked. When you're told who is guilty and how it's been worked, I will just never forget that. It was just like being slapped across the face. It was an amazingly revelatory moment, I think, just in my reading, full stop.
It's that mixture between it's almost like an early psychological thriller as well as this incredible mystery novel, but the solution is also psychological and fits exactly with the tensions and everything that you've seen going on so far. It's not like, oh, and there was this kind of place that someone could have hidden, or there was this kind of stupid mechanical solution. The solution fits with the feel of the story so well. It's just wonderful.
Mm.
So there it is, listeners. That is JJ's top 15 locked room mysteries of all time. Hearing that again, just going through it and seeing them coming out in that order, what do you think? What's kind of your reflections on it now?
I appreciate a couple of things. I appreciate, firstly, how difficult it is to make these lists to begin with.
Oh my gosh. You don't know, listeners. You don't even know how the last few weeks have been for us. We've lost our jobs.
I have lost so much weight.
Our wives have left us.
Incredible. Yeah, so I appreciate how difficult it is to make these lists in the first place. One of the nice things about this is, like, I've read, you know, several hundred, I reckon, impossible crime novels. And at the same time, I do very distinctly feel that if we do this again in, let's say, 5 years' time, books that I have not yet read would probably be on this list. I don't feel as if I've seen all of the best of impossible crime fiction, which is lovely, because if I'd got to this point and I was like, no, that's it, that is definitively the best 15, and I will never read anything else, I think that would be... I'd feel a bit sad.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are impossible crime novels on my shelves at the moment that I have not read, and I firmly suspect a couple of them are going to be good enough. Quite which places they're going to take, I have no idea. That will be my problem when I next want to lose some weight. There are going to be some brilliant pre-1981 novels that I just haven't come across yet. And I'm very heartened by the fact that I've read so much brilliant stuff inside of the genre, equally, I believe there is still so much brilliant stuff inside of the genre yet to discover.
Well, maybe if we still run this podcast in 3 to 5 years' time or something, we should do it all again, see where we are then.
Maybe we could do like a, maybe even if we stop, we could do like a Jonathan Creek special.
Oh, yeah.
Come back and do another one and attempt to recapture old glories that everybody hates.
Except me, maybe. I'll still love it. Except I'll find something to love. Okay, well, there it is, ladies and gentlemen. You heard it here first, JJ's top 15 Nocturne mysteries of all time. Join us in the next episode where I will be revealing my top 15 Nocturne mysteries. As ever, thanks for listening and see you next time.
See you next time.